It's Wednesday. It's 1 o'clock. It's time for the Indie Media Radio London show, brought to you on Resonance FM 104.4, bringing protest stories direct from the streets, posted onto the indiemedia.org.uk newswire and to global indie media sites worldwide. We look forward to presenting your stories, so keep posting them to indiemedia.org.uk. Hello, it's Wednesday the 9th of November, and in amidst the chaos that is the Indie Media Radio Show, we have some very exciting things happening today. We have Zoe Young, who's just finished making a film called Pumping Poverty for Friends of the Earth, which is a film about international financial institutions and the extractive industries. She's going to be playing an interview from that film. And we also have Billy, the amazing fiddler from the Sonsi Folk Band. And we're going to be talking to Billy because he's going to be doing a benefit gig at Ramparts. And he's going to tell us what the benefit gig is for when we chat to him. We also have a new presenter. We have Doogie, who has been wandering, gathering news, he says, in a situationist fashion in Paris. And he's going to be talking about what he's seen in Paris. And you're going to be hearing another voice reading the stories, which we always bring to you, as you know. Now, we're going to have a chat with Zoe, first of all. Are you ready, Zoe? Yeah. Yay. Went to see Zoe's film. It was premiered at the Ritzy in the bar, and it was a really good crowd, Pumping Poverty. What made you make the film?
I was asked to make it by Friends of the Earth International, who'd organised a speakers tour. People coming from Guatemala, Nigeria, Ghana and Georgia to Western European capitals to demand an end to public funding for oil, mining and gas in their countries. Because this is being done in the name of helping the poor and the environment, and it's actually making people poorer and destroying the environment in their countries. So they had to come here to try and put a stop to this and raise awareness.
When they were doing the speaking tour, did they get much satisfaction from speaking to the institutions that are designed to help?
Mixed results. They got quite a good hearing from parliamentarians. Quite a few of them definitely wanted to help. There's an international parliamentary petition going on now to demand accountability from the World Bank and other financial institutions that every year parliaments, like the UK Parliament, for example, votes hundreds of millions of pounds to the World Bank, but they don't actually have any say over how it's spent, which is a somewhat undemocratic, unaccountable situation. Actually, from the officials, less.
Yeah. So you're talking about the World Bank, and also about you have a website that has information, more information about people, about how the bank is spending the money. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, there's a whole range of organisations worldwide who'd monitor the World Bank, IMF, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is also based in London, and all these other sort of faceless acronyms that are taking taxpayers' money and using it around the world without us having any say. One new website, it's a couple of years old, and it brings together all these different institution monitoring organisations worldwide, and it's called www.ifiwatchnet.org. And the beautiful thing about this is that you can do a search on any institution, issue, country, and you can pull up documents, events, films, whatever covers that issue, and you can find it, whether it's from the smallest little organisation in Bangladesh or from Oxfam UK. The only important thing is that it be independent of the donor agencies. So there's also this film that I've just made is listed on the film section of that. There's now 86 films listed in there, and that's called ifiwatch.tv. And so if you're interested to see films online, quite a few of them are online available. Otherwise, you can get contact with the people who are selling copies of the film. You can get screening quality versions. You can also find out when screenings are, if they're in your town, things like that.
Are you going to play us an excerpt from the film?
That's the plan.
So we're hoping, if we can get our DVD player to work, we're going to be playing an excerpt from that later. Right now, we're going to go to a track, and I really want to play today Sinead O'Connor's Black Boys on Mopeds, because I thought, with all the situation in Paris, I thought it seemed very, very relevant. And we're just going to go for that now. We are in complete technical chaos today. So keep listening and stay patient with us while we sort all of this out.
Margaret Thatcher on TV, shocked by the deaths that took place in Beijing. It seems strange that she should be offended. The same orders are given by her. I've said this before now. You said I was childish and you'll say it now. Remember what I told you. If they hated me, they will hate you. England's not the mythical land of Madame George and her roses. It's the home of police who kill black boys on mopeds. And I love my boy, and that's why I'm leaving. I don't want him to be aware that there's any such thing as grieving. Young mother down Smithfield, 5 a.m. looking for food for her kids. In her arms she holds 3 cold babies, and the first word that they learned was please. England's not the mythical land of Madame George and roses. It's the home of police who kill black boys on no kids. And I love my boy, and that's why I'm leaving. I don't want him to be aware that there's any such thing as grief.
And welcome back from Sinead O'Connor's Black Boys on Mopeds. And now Zoe's going to tell us a bit more about Pumping Poverty.
What I'm going to play for you now is one of the web clips that we made, giving a bit more background on one of the characters in the film. He's called Asume Oswoka, and he comes from Environmental Rights Action, which is based in the Niger Delta of Nigeria. And as he'll explain, this is a part of the world which has been ravaged by the oil companies, which are backed by not only private banks, the kinds that you and I will have a bank account with, unless we're boycotting them, of course, but also the World Bank, which is backed by our governments. So I think he can express the situation there a lot better than us. We're going to hear later about some of the other problems caused by Shell in particular, one of the oil companies that has such a lovely green image here these days, but the dirt is behind.
Transnational oil corporations, including Shell, Chevron Texaco, ExxonMobil, Totalfina Elf, have been operating in Nigeria and ravaging the environment of the Niger Delta area and colluding with soldiers and members of the political elite to subvert the economy of the country. I have lived in the Niger Delta area of Nigeria for most of my life, Some of the fondest memories that I have as a child is going fishing. After school, we used to take our hooks and our nets and just go to the stream, to the rivers and the swamps, wherever we choose. It was part recreation, part walk. All that is gone. Children who are born now do not know what it's like to fish, because these resources have been destroyed by the activities of transnational corporations. Gas is released, burned indiscriminately to hundreds of locations, polluting the air, you know, polluting the soil, and preventing people from planting and getting yield for their crops. This has been going on for over 40 years. This is an activity that will not be allowed anywhere in Europe where these companies come from. This is a clear case of racism and contempt for our people. And we have said that this should stop. And the only way the company says that they can only reduce flaring if they find a market for the gas. Okay, they say they have found a market in Ghana, because gold mines in Ghana now need the gas to power their machines. So why don't you use the associated gas that is being flared to transport to the markets that I imagine? They choose not to, because it is easier to use an abundant supply of non-associated gas, which is usually not being flared. So you find a situation where gas, huge investments of this nature are still being developed without addressing the continuing flaring of gas. The people in government consider the people as an impediment. You know, they don't need the people. The people can die, the institutions can die, the universities can collapse, the healthcare facilities can collapse. It doesn't bother them, because the oil flows and the revenue comes and they take this money and bring them back to European banks. The World Bank is supporting, you know, basically American corporations to profiteer from our people in the name of aid. The companies could seek for credit from whichever sources, but they needed the World Bank. Why the World Bank? Because the World Bank facilitates this debt regime, this whole debt picture which our countries are tied to. The companies know that, and they want the World Bank to come and compel this government to accept the contractual terms, which are very criminal if you look at it. These are contract terms that even override the entire legislations of countries. Chad Cameroon pipeline, the contract between the companies and the government is superior, more or less, to the constitution of the countries involved. And they couldn't achieve this to guarantee maximum profits without the involvement of the World Bank. And you should be happy, you should crawl and beg, you know, because some Father Christmas have given you aid. What kind of aid is that? You take the resources of the people, you degrade the environment, you kill them, and you give them a few pittance, and you say it is aid. We have to get to the root of this and expose the fraud that is going on. We want more effort on the part of organizations here to pressure your own government, because we believe and understand that your government have some level of influence in these institutions as investors. As you pressure your government to ensure that taxpayers' money should not be used to support projects that lead to more massacres of our people, to impoverishment of our people. That is, the little that we ask.
And that was from Zoe Young's film for Away Cat Productions called Pumping Poverty. And now, related to Shell's activities, we have Billy in the studio, as I said, from the band Sonsi Folk. And he's going to be doing a benefit gig at Ramparts, the squatted space in East London, this Saturday. But what are you going to be doing a benefit gig for?
Well, the sort of stuff that's taking place with what Shell are doing in Nigeria is happening over here as well. At the moment, Shell are currently trying to build a gas refinery over in Mayo in Ireland. They've basically stolen a fair amount of land for building gas pipelines near two villages. They're building it in a set of protected wetlands. If they follow the normal pattern, you can guarantee that the water source for the people that live around there is going to be completely screwed. It's, how was it, 3-4 other boys who were living in the local area have spent all summer in jail. No charges. Stuck on remand. Without,
How can they remand them without charges?
Your guess is as good as mine. Whether the Irish government are just acting as enforcement for what Shell actually want, but that sort of stuff has been taking place, both in Nigeria, and it's happening over here. Stuff like that. We didn't get so much hassle with that back in Scotland, but then we got sharper lawyers back here. As it is, we're doing the best. There's going to be about four guest speakers talking at Rampart, describing the sort of stuff that's going on, along with a couple of videos and films explaining what's giving you a better idea of the background than I can explain. It's 8 o'clock onwards at Rampart, 15 Rampart Street, EC1. Saturday the 12th of November.
And you're going to play for us now?
We're playing the Kelly Band. We're doing some tunes later on, so there should be some good tunes going, some good dances happening.
I've always wanted live music on the Indie Media Radio Show, and this is, you're our first live musician that we've ever had on the Indie Media Newswire, so hey. Welcome.
Happy to. Hey.
Enough frivolity. We have too much frivolity. People are starting to think we're enjoying ourselves. We're going to have some news.
Okay. Well, you can't see on the radio, but what we could see in the studio was that guy's fingers moving. Was completely amazing. I'm really glad that that gig's already in my diary. So news from the summit of the Americas. Leaders of all the countries of the Western Hemisphere, except Cuba, met in Mar del Plata in Argentina from October the 28th through to November the 5th for the fourth summit of the Americas. Protests began in Argentina 3 days before Bush's arrival. A massive security clampdown was put in place for the talks. More than 7,500 police officers erected a security ring around summit hotels and patrolled the streets and beaches. Coast Guard boats watched the shoreline and airspace was restricted. Most schools cancelled classes. Talk on the resumption of negotiations on creating the US proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, ended in a deadlock after a group of left-leaning countries headed by Brazil and Venezuela opposed the idea, saying it would open their countries to exploitation by large American firms and do little to alleviate poverty. A huge people's summit was organised and thousands attended the various rallies, protests and events. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez told a crowd of more than 20,000 protesters that the FTAA was a branch of American imperialism. Only united can we defeat imperialism and bring our people a better life, he said, adding, here in Mar del Plata, the FTAA will be buried. The presence of US President George W. Bush at the summit of the Americas unleashed a wave of popular outrage in both Argentina and Uruguay. Tens of thousands demonstrated and marched in Argentina on Friday the 4th of September. As the main march approached the security fence, the police fired tear gas canisters and some rubber bullets. Throughout the afternoon, over 1,000 people fought with police, setting bonfires in the streets and destroying banks, shops and corporate offices. Over 87 people were arrested, including two indie media journalists. Here we listen to some background discussion from an anti-FTAA campaigner about the effects of agreements such as the FTAA and the standalone bilateral agreements the US has been making with individual countries.
Well, we've already seen, I mean, the FTAA, I'll go into the specifics. We already know the FTAA and agreements like NAFTA have really outlined the sort of devastating ramifications that these agreements can have on, especially on rural poor populations, but on just about every sector every sort of productive sector, especially in Latin American nations. But I mean, Canada has suffered from various investor-state disputes as well. Well, the famous Chapter 11 of NAFTA that allows for these investor-state disputes where, you know, corporations can sue governments for imposing labor conditions, minimum wages, or environmental laws and restrictions and whatnot. So we know, I mean, the FTAA wasn't going to be great. It was going to be horrible. That's why we're all mobilizing against it. The bilaterals are that much worse because now you don't have the negotiating power of countries like Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, who have a lot of economic clout and whose reticence to move forward in the FTAA negotiations were deciding factors in the stalling of FTAA negotiations. So you don't have that bargaining power. I mean, the states negotiating with a country like Ecuador, what they bring, what a free trade agreement with a country like Ecuador will bring to the U.S. GDP is extremely insignificant. They don't have any bargaining power. So the terms that can be demanded and imposed are a lot more extreme. Issues of intellectual property rights are a really big deal. In Ecuador, there's going to be, proposed to be this law of biodiversity, which will allow for basically the privatization of areas that are very rich in biodiversity, including the Amazon region. I mean, lots of regions that are delineated as national parks in Ecuador will ultimately be up for pretty much privatization. And just sort of the language that they're using also about biodiversity, things like, you know, environmental services. And that allows also for the privatization, the commercialization of these things. So it's just a question of being able to go further in the bilaterals because each country, you know, they no longer have that sort of block negotiating power, but they're on their own.
Anti-FTA campaigner Burissa Mary Mendez, and we'll be hearing more from her at the end of the show. Independent media coverage from the streets of Mar del Plata was provided by Indie Media Argentina. You can check out the reports, pictures and audio at argentina.indiemedia.org and global indie media site at indiemedia.org.
Last Wednesday in London, campaigners numbering in the thousands took part in a mass lobby of MPs demanding trade justice, not free trade, ahead of the WTO ministerial meeting in Hong Kong this December. They assembled in regional groups, snaking from Parliament over the bridge and right along the other side of the Thames back up to Parliament Bridge. This was the first major event for the trade justice movement since the Make Poverty History rally and march the weekend before the G8 summit in Scotland. While many, both inside and outside of the Make Poverty History Coalition, have criticised the campaign for being too simplistic, superficial and compromised by pop stars and politicians, the campaigning for a more just world continues. Last Wednesday, they were lobbying their MPs to support the calls to stop pushing poor countries to open their economies through world trade talks and to respect poor countries' right to decide on trade policies to help end poverty and protect their environment. Campaigners were also using their MPs to sign the Trade Justice Early Day Motion 679, making poverty history through trade justice. Similar lobby efforts were also happening in other countries, and a European-wide lobby will take place in Brussels on the 21st of November. In the UK so far, 600,000 people have already added their support to the Vote for the Trade Justice campaign. Now we're going to go to France. The widespread disturbances have continued for the 13th night, and a 12-day state of emergency has now been declared, allowing officials to impose local curfews and giving police additional powers of search. The terms also allow people to be put under house arrest and give powers to ban or limit the movement of people and vehicles and to close public spaces where people gather. The 50-year-old state of emergency law was originally drawn up to quell unrest in Algeria during its war of independence from France and was last used in December 1984. The violence started in October the 27th in a northeast Paris suburb, angry over the accidental deaths of two teenagers who were electrocuted while reportedly hiding from police in a power substation. However, just 2 days prior to that, Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy was pelted with stones and bottles in a Paris suburb. Sarkozy said the Banalou estate should be cleaned up with a power hose and had previously ordered an increase in policing to tackle urban crime. Much of the media has reported the riots in terms of social exclusion and poverty, racial discrimination and the depressed states of France's sink estates, a description familiar to anyone who has ever visited such areas in France. The response by the French authorities has been widely criticised, and Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy in particular has been blamed by many for increasing tensions with inflammatory rhetoric. In a humorous riposte, internet users have Googled Sarkozy. So if you enter his name into the Google Francis website, the first result you get on searching for Nicolas Sarkozy is no good. There are lots of reports, there are tons of blogs and coverage on the web, and check out Global Indie Media for some of those stories. But Dougie, you were actually in Paris and you went looking for... You went looking for riots?
Well, not exactly. I mean, of course, because my insane insistence on not flying for reasons of not encouraging global warming, I was helping out a friend in an arts festival in Valencia. And on my way back, I had 6 hours to fill between and had to get from the Gare d'Austerlitz, which is in southwest Paris, just south of the Seine, and the Gare du Nord to get the Eurostar back. So I thought I'll go on a Derivé-style investigation of this story. And, of course, you know, one might imagine from reading the newspapers and seeing the graphics that there are kind of flames all over Paris lighting up. But in fact, life seems to be going very much as normal. I read in Le Monde that about 4,000 cars have been trashed in the troubles. But I'm afraid they're going to have to try a lot harder if they're going to make any impact on the traffic in Paris. The traffic was absolutely appalling at 9 in the morning, stinking fumes and very noisy. Anyway, I read that the trouble was in the northeast suburbs, so I thought I'd walk up northeast using the sun as my guide. And in fact, I think I understand the riots very well now. You pass through very chic streets with these rather splendid Parisian ladies walking along, and lovely patisseries and rather smart boutiques. And then you get up to the cemetery where Oscar Wilde is buried, and then pass through there to another rather beautiful suburb. And then you get to the Périphérique, and over the Périphérique is some not so glamorous suburbs. And then as you cross the RER, the suburban railway, then it starts to get really grim. And sure enough, I turn left, and there's two black kids, 14 years old, being chased by two cops who both look rather overweight, like they've been driving too much. And I thought the kids were probably going to get away. I could have tripped any of the participants in the chase, but I decided to retain my journalistic objectivity, and they just passed by and went around the corner. I don't know what the outcome of that was. And basically what I can report from my dérivé through Paris is that the class and race gradient is very obvious as you walk on that northeast segment. I guess I walked for about 4 hours. It does get kind of grimmer and grimmer and grimmer. And then I got on the RER and was back at the Gare du Nord in 8 minutes.
And now Billy's going to play us a French song. And why are you going to play us a French song?
Hey, it's a French story. Thank you.
was gorgeous. What's that called?
About a 200-year-old Breton gin. Don't know the name of it.
From France. How did you learn it? Where did you find it?
Learned it from a French guitarist. Guy I used to play with a few years back.
Wow. As we just mentioned, the sixth ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization will take place from December the 13th to the 18th, 2005. A network of activists and campaigners are bustling with activity ahead of the WTO meeting, with two key organizations being the Hong Kong People's Alliance on the WTO and the Stop the New Round Coalition. Peasants and small farmers from the Philippines, Indonesia, Taiwan, Thailand and Korea are getting organized to go to Hong Kong, mobilise against corporate globalisation and present alternative proposals. Conferences, cultural events, mass mobilisations and direct actions are being planned between December the 11th and December the 18th. Organising momentum has increased with a string of strategy meetings and declarations by Asian, regional, NGO and social movements. One declaration earlier in the summer said, "We workers, organised and unorganised, peasants, Dalits, indigenous peoples, fisher folks, women, students, migrants and other marginalised communities of Asia, in solidarity with other peoples of the world, will stand at the forefront of the global struggle against the Hong Kong ministerial meeting."
London's oldest surviving squatty street, St Agnes Place, is once again under threat. St Agnes Place is a 30-year-old ethnically diverse community and home to the International Rastafarian Headquarters, a place Bobby Marley frequented during the 1970s. The council want to redevelop the street with new housing and claim St Agnes Place is riddled with crime, yet the street has a much lower average crime rate than neighbouring areas. St Agnes Place resisted eviction several times in the late 70s and more recently in 2003, but now the council have gained permission to begin sending bailiffs in, which could happen any time now. The community are asking that people get down there and help if and when a mass eviction begins. Another community facing trouble are the residents of Allington Road, South Kilburn. Brent Council are evicting Brent Community Housing, BCH co-op tenants. For more, see allingtonroadsos.org.
Last week, five protesters were found guilty of aggravated trespass for blocking a Sainsbury's depot in Bristol, which distributed milk from cows fed on GM crops. Four of those convicted had no previous criminal record, but were given 50 hours community service. The fifth got 65 hours. The judge agreed that the protesters had conducted their actions in the belief that they were protecting the public. However, he also judged that they had planned to harm Sainsbury's shareholders through their actions, and importantly, he said he had considered giving them curfews and antisocial behavioural orders. Campaigners say that the antisocial behaviour orders are being increasingly used against protesters. The agency to be of being used increasingly against shareholders. I'm sorry about that. My script has printed out curiously.
Okay. Good news for campaigners in Ireland. The trial of the Trident Ploughshares activists has collapsed. More on that next week. And this Saturday also sees a European demonstration of sound systems and free arts in Strasbourg, home of the European Parliament. The protest is against repression of technivals and free parties and has been prompted not least by the brutal attack on a free party by Czechoslovakia riot police earlier in the summer. For more, see europe.soundcircle, that's sound, all one word, C-I-R-K-L-E-R-K-E. I'm going to have to repeat that. That's sound, circle, C-I-R-K-L-E dot info. And that's circle spelled C-I-R-K-L-E.
And Gudmundur Gunnarsson, the father of pop star Bjork, has described 2B, an employment agency that recruits Polish workers for a hydro dam in Iceland, as engaged in organised crime. This comes in response to reports by workers that a representative from the agency 2B advised a site foreman to use beatings to punish any Poles who showed any resistance. Gunnarsson was speaking in his capacity as leader of the Icelandic Electricians Union. His remarks have been widely reported by Icelandic media, and 2B have threatened to sue for libel. The Kárannyókutska dam, designed to power an aluminium smelter, has been opposed by environmentalists who say that it will destroy areas of valuable Arctic highland, and the campaign to oppose it has been featured several times on this radio show. For more on that campaign, and do check out www.savingiceland.org.
this Saturday. Yeah, we've had that one.
Okay, we're going to go to some music now. We're going to have Billy for one more track before we say goodbye and go to our outro. So what are you going to play for us now?
Good question. Well, when we tune Till Farewell to Erin, which is, I think, originally a Scottish tune played by Irish immigrants when they were legging it out of Ireland and heading over to the States.
Up this week, we're going to go out with an outro piece right now, which we hope you enjoy, and keep posting your stories to the Indie Media website. Just want to say thank you to Zoe for coming in and presenting Pumping Poison. Pumping Poverty. I think it should be called Pumping Poison. Thank you to Billy for coming in, and don't forget, do go to the gig at Ramparts, and thank you for Dougie for your first session ever on the Indie Media Radio London show.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, me. Okay. Bye bye.
Who would Jesus kill? The double talk is past surreal. The word of God is now the word of hate. War is peace and freedom is the police state. Can't you see the writing on the wall? Democracy lays trampled on the floor. You better believe that, hell yeah, I'm confused for sure. What I thought was the new millennium is 1984. Mr. Orwell from the grave, adding fresh ink to the page as the young president declares an end to war. Welcome to 1984. Feels like Nazi Germany and Hitler on TV as the young president spews homophobic speech. Didn't the Allies fight a war to end extremist fascist laws? So tell me now, what are the fuck we fighting for? I just cannot take it anymore. Democracy lays trampled on the floor. Man, isn't freedom great? Hell yeah, I'm confused for sure. What I thought was the new millennium is 1984. Mr. Orwell from the grave, adding fresh ink to the page as the young president declares an endless war. Now we've got armies of peace, armed to the teeth.
to live in death to make the world a better place. So celebrate the weapons, spend it, say a toast to Armageddon, raise some hell. We're all headed straight to hell. Hell yeah, I'm confused for sure. What I thought was the new millennium is 1984. Mr. Orwell from the grave, adding fashion to the page as the young president declares an endless war. Welcome to 1984.
In Argentina, the cursed warlord Bush has taken a great defeat. The so-called free trade area of the Americas is in shambles. The enemy reports no progress in the summit. Outside, thousands of protesters pouring into the streets, sacking the wealthy, building bonfires of resistance, storming through the streets of Argentina. The free peoples of Earth, especially of Latin America, have given George Bush and the free trade area of the Americas the mother of all beatdowns on November the 4th. Here at WSQT Guerrilla Radio, we stand in full solidarity with these efforts of resistance that just took place in Argentina.
Yeah, I can speak mostly in terms of my experience living in Ecuador, working with the Peasant Federation there. While I was there, the Summit of the Americas in fall of 2003 occurred, where the shift of the focus went kind of from the FTA to the bilaterals, and social movements like the Peasant Federation, the indigenous movement in Ecuador, kind of realized that this is what they had to mobilize around. But it was a huge challenge because while, you know, mobilizing resistance to the FTA had been so fruitful, there were still a lot of challenges. A lot of people, you know, in the community bases still didn't know what the FTA was. The question of sort of popular education and access to information was still a big one. And now the focus was shifting to the bilaterals. And it was like a whole other struggle because whereas with FTAA, you had this international solidarity and you could have these really strong networks and everybody was under it and everybody could kind of tap into the idea of how their population would be affected. With the bilaterals, you know, they're all on their own and new campaigns of information had to be spread. It was really scary just because it's also much more of a menace. I mean, I don't know much more, but it's as I said before, that much worse with all these specifications, basically selling away any natural resources or, you know, labor. And I mean, in Ecuador, the acronym for FTA, Free Trade Agreement, is TLC. And we would say Tratando de Liquidar Campesinos, which means trying to liquidate peasants, because that is ultimately what the ramifications of the bilateral will be in a country like Ecuador with a lot of rural agricultural workers. What we started doing basically was trying to initiate campaigns of popular information. On April 17th, the International Day of Peasant Struggles, we had the first mobilization against the bilateral free trade agreement in Ecuador, and went trying to create links of solidarity with Peru, Colombia, Bolivia, because those countries, they're all in the negotiations together. Right now, since I've left, the campaign has continued. There's a campaign in Ecuador specifically called Ecuador Decide. The idea is to create a constituent assembly that will make the decision about whether the bilateral should pass rather than the government's Congress, which is obviously dominated generally by elites who are willing to let these things go through. And there have been huge mobilizations. The first, we had the one in Ecuador in April 15th of 2004. But the opening of the negotiations of the Andean bilateral free trade agreements was May 15th of that year, and 300,000 people were out in the streets in Cartagena, in Colombia, where they were taking place. Since then, there were supposed to be something like 5 rounds of negotiations, something, you know, very short, about 4 months to sign the agreements. Since then, there have been 12. The 13th is going to be this month in Guayaquil, in Ecuador. Supposedly, it's supposed to be the last one. There have been mobilizations around everyone. Even there was one in Arizona. The mobilizations were very small because in the United States, I think that there's a lot less awareness about the bilaterals. And around the Central American Free Trade Agreements, there were huge mobilizations all sort of winter and spring of this year. That's when, around the time when they were being signed. 2 people were killed by security forces in Guatemala in March. And since then, yeah, in the Andean regions, they keep mobilizing. I mean, it's an onward struggle.
I've been watching the wolves. They broke out from cages and following dirty, useless clown. Got your cats lost in a gypsy part of town. I got the bottom wide, the fire, the sack, the shredded my foundations out. For deep, the man, the queen of me. I got far about love, I'm my sad day.